Hello. Students of the French Revolution in recent decades will be familiar with the work of William Doyle, whose works on the period of political madness and turmoil and tumult, which marked the events in France in the late 1780s and early 1790s, will have saved many an essay crisis. His Oxford Book of the French Revolution, it was published in 2002, I think. It was the year I myself was an undergraduate historian grappling with the sheer complexity of this fascinating period. Now, William Doyle, now Emeritus Professor of History at the University of Bristol, has written books on all sorts of related subjects, about the Ancien Régime and then how that then transposes through to the Revolution and thereafter. Venality in 18th century France, the role of aristocracy within French society, Catholic resistance to authority. These are all so interesting and important when it comes to understanding what was going on in France in the 1790s, all interesting. I must say, though, that I think there's something very impressive about works of synthesis, like, for example, The French Revolution, A Very Short Introduction, which are superb for those in a hurry, let's say. Now, Professor Doyle's latest book is on the subject of what happened next. Not in a question of sport terms, but what happened after the French Revolution. It's his latest book, Napoleon at Peace, takes a look at those initial post-revolutionary years and that transition from the Directory to a government increasingly, very quickly dominated by one man. Professor Doyle, William, it's great to have you on the Napoleonic Quarterly. Thank you for taking the time.
My pleasure.
I have so much to ask you about because we've been spending, you know, where we've got to right now is we're just embarking on the 19th century. So the first third of our main episodes are complete. We've done 1792 to 1799. And it's sort of, you know, with Napoleon Bonaparte now in power, it's sort of a case of washing our hands of the revolution and putting that behind us. But I think, as we've just found, we've just now recorded a segment on the first 3 months of 1800 and that big to-do list of the new government dealing with the war, trying to solve the religious question, and then these issues of executive power. It's simply not the case. You know, there is a historical shortcut that many people will take in putting the revolution to one side. But actually, as your new book explores, Napoleon at Peace in those initial years, he had an awful lot to do to try to move. That was his task, really, of moving France on from the 1790s and the revolution.
Yes, certainly. I mean, what I tried to do in that book is not just show what Napoleon did, but to show how the problems which he confronted had evolved. Because, you know, my overall idea is that the original project of the revolution is completely blown off course by revolutionary events. And the problems that Napoleon has to solve are ones that weren't there before the revolution. They were problems created by the revolution, which the revolution was then unable to resolve. And that's the remarkable thing, which he actually is able to do. You know, there was the whole question of the relation of church and state wasn't there before 1789. The whole question of monarchy wasn't there before 1789. These were all things that existed, and that's the way it actually was. And there was no war on, of course. I mean, it takes 3 years after the revolution breaks out before a war comes about. But then that war, it seems to be unresolvable. It just seems to spiral on and on, just as the religious question, which goes back to the civil constitution of the clergy in 1790, also spirals on, not to mention the sort of underlying violence lawlessness that the revolution appears to have brought to the country. And then there's the question of, okay, the France becomes a republic in 1792, but it's perfectly clear that huge swathes of the population are completely unreconciled to that. So that's how these problems actually arose. And in the book, I know I try to go back and look back how they arose as a way of showing what difficulties Napoleon would have to deal with.
Yes, you rather put me in mind of a puddle or pond which had been clear, but then some toddler runs in with their Wellington boots or a stick or something and stirs it all up. All that muddy sediment makes the water, yeah, clear as mud.
Yeah, the interesting thing is, you know, Napoleon says when he presents the Constitution of 1799. For the referendum, he said, "A constitution is offered to you. The revolution is established on the principles with which it began." Now, that is actually a very bold claim to make, and in some ways, it's true, in the sense that national sovereignty is respected, and establishing national as opposed to royal sovereignty is a fundamental aspect of 1789. That's the great transfer of sovereignty, which is fundamental. That's the revolutionary moment, as it were. And that's acknowledged by Napoleon always. This is why whenever he changes constitutional or tries to change constitutional arrangements, he does it with a plebiscite. Okay, they are rigged in various ways and so on, but nevertheless, it's bowing to the idea that the nation is the ultimate sovereign. So in that sense, the revolution is established on the principles of which it began, but then all sorts of other things like representative government and things like that are not there.
Well, one thought that occurs to me here is that Napoleon Bonaparte had to make, he couldn't exist in a vacuum. He was coming into this live situation. And it's a sort of question of, was it verbiage that, how much spin was he putting on developments? And sometimes that's viewed in a pejorative way by the people who would rather be sort of a little bit cynical or negative about Napoleon Bonaparte. Equally, you have others who are big fans of him who think he's doing marvellously and are swallowing it all very happily indeed.
Are you talking about contemporaries or about historians?
Oh, definitely historians. Yeah, those looking. Yeah. Although, that's an interesting question. What were their contemporary views about whether he was great or not so great?
Yes, I mean, right from the start, some people were predicting that ultimately the revolution would be brought to an end by a soldier seizing power. The revolutionaries are very reluctant to believe this, but Edmund Burke predicted it when he wrote his Reflections on the Revolution in 1790. Robespierre always used to raise it as a danger that the revolution was in. So a lot of people have said, here it is. This is what we've been fearing all that time, a soldier taking control of things. So, a lot of people there at the time are very worried by what's happening there. But on the other hand, a lot of other people are saying, well, thank God there's someone who is actually imposing control and pulling things together rather than letting these apparently insoluble problems continue to plague us.
And what strikes me about your approach as a historian here is that you're emphasizing the pragmatism of the man, that he needs to, he's in this particular context, and there's so many different groups that he's having to deal with here. You have to sort of dive in, as it were, and get stuck in.
Yeah. I mean, I came to Napoleon actually quite late, long after I got into the revolution. And generally speaking, historians are divided about this. The historians of the revolution tend not to like what Napoleon actually does, and tend to be very hostile to Napoleon. And Napoleonic historians tend to belittle the revolution and accept his view that the whole thing was a chaotic mess, and only he could actually resolve it. So there's always been a big divide, I think, between people who are committed to the revolution, people who are committed to Napoleon. And in some ways, what I've tried to do is bring the two sides together, as it were, and not exclude one to the disadvantage of the other. But what hit me, as I say, I came to Napoleon quite late, is the sheer ability of the man. Most Napoleonic people, I think, are impressed by his military achievements, and quite rightly so. But that's never interested me very much. But what's really impressed me always is how able he actually was, how many balls he was able to keep in the air at any particular time. And whatever you think of him morally, and he's a very nasty type in all sorts of ways, nevertheless, the sheer ability of the man, I mean, cannot fail to be impressive, I think.
That's so interesting. And I completely get what you're saying about those two camps of historians, the Napoleonic historians and the French Revolutionary historians. Well, of course, your book, Napoleon at Peace, it's Napoleon at Peace, : How to End a Revolution. And I suppose part of the reason French revolutionary historians are frustrated is because, as you say, they see him as the soldier who comes in. But there is, the question of when the French Revolution ends is such an interesting essay title. what would be your sense of how much the revolution had already ended by the time we got to Brumaire?
None of it, apart from the terror, apart from the fact that no one tries to rule through terror in the way that the convention and the Committee of Public Safety did in 1793-4. But otherwise, that's the whole point. The thing is unresolved in 1799. And Napoleon's been saying to himself for several, or so he reminisces anyway later on, that he said to himself as early as 1796, "I am the one who will end the revolution." Later on, he said, one reads this in the memoirs of Chaptal, who was one of his interior ministers. Chaptal said, "Napoleon often used to say, when I came to power, the revolution was not over." But he saw his job as making sure that it was going to be over. He said several times the revolution's over. He was saying it to the royalists, the end of 1799 and so on, tell your followers the revolution is over. It wasn't. But by the time you get to 1802, it is over, I think. And Napoleon wants to celebrate that, as he does at the great Easter service in 1802, which celebrates both the Concordat and the final peace with France's last enemy, Great Britain.
I suppose the great beauty of the revolution is arguing, it's great fun to argue about when the revolution sold out. And a lot of people point to Fructidor, that moment when the Directory said, hang on, these elections, it's not working out. Let's take a step back from democracy.
Yeah, I think that is right, actually, because what Fructidor is acknowledging is that if you allow free elections, what you're going to get is a royalist majority, and that will destroy the republic. So the Fructidor is intended, I think, to save the republic from the possibility of a royalist restoration.
Yeah, but just because that's dealt with, it's not incompatible with the idea that actually so much is now in flux that still needs to be resolved. That some of the ideals of the revolution might have been compromised and perhaps lost by Fructidor, but there's still so much going on that the country has not yet moved on. It hasn't had that opportunity to do so.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, I admire the ambition of the people who drafted the Constitution of the Year Three, in fact, because, they are trying to get back to the original aspirations of the revolution while correcting one or two of the things that they feel had spoilt it. It's an honest attempt to put together a workable republican constitution and so on. But the problem is, if you allow free elections, then you might get results you don't actually like. And that's what happened in the spring of 1797.
Yeah, God forbid. But there it is. Yeah, that's the great problem with democracy, I suppose. Not that they.
Yeah, it is. Yes.
Yeah. Okay,
let's jump back to the early 1790s, and you'd spent so long writing about that period and talking about it and thinking about it. Has anything changed in your view of the French Revolution? Obviously, I'm talking in very general terms, but over the period of your career, of course, you're well known as a revisionist historian.
Yeah,
but I sort of maybe put that to one side, but how's your own thinking about the French Revolution developed over the decades you've been working on it?
Well, most of the revisionism I've been accused of has been about my writings on the origins of the revolution, which is the area really where all the great controversies in the late 20th century among historians are actually operative. The one thing which has evolved in my mind over the years is, in fact, a reassessment of the Girondins. Seems to me that the Girondins were far more radical, far less moderate, and far more committed in many ways to the ideals of the early revolution than their Montagnard opponents, even though the Montagnards tried to take over the orthodoxy of the revolution. I suppose that's the thing which has emerged over the years in my mind, and which I'm still turning over and still writing about again.
That's so interesting, because I suppose the problem is when you look at these, not, I hesitate to call them, the sort of quasi political factions, is that because so much was changing so fast, their response to, you know, they didn't have years to develop a platform. They were almost a response, a tendency in response to these particular circumstances. And this podcast project, we started in the first 3 months of 1792, when war breaks out, you know, so very much midway through the revolution. But war is I suppose one of those big factors that a pressure cooker that it creates.
I mean, in the famous words, I forget which historian said it, and maybe in Georges Lefebvre and so on, the war revolutionized the revolution. Now, one could argue, actually, that I would tend to argue that before that, it's the religious issue which revolutionizes the revolution. I think the religious issue is the most fundamental thing about the revolution. But the war undoubtedly, you know, forces people off the fence. It's intended to force people off the fence. It's intended to make people choose. But if you make people choose, they sometimes choose in ways that... they don't want to, but they have no choice. I mean, we've seen that with Brexit in some ways.
I won't comment on that. Yikes! But when it comes to, what about war and the Girondins? How do you see? I mean, it was Brissot, wasn't it, who was so gung ho about the war?
If you like, this is the Girondins' big mistake. If you like, that they feel that war will force people off the fence and so on, but in advocating war as a way of doing it, they plunge the country into all sorts of problems that they hadn't foreseen, and they themselves didn't really have a plan of how to run a war which is going badly, I think, and that's their greatest flaw. I think they were committed so strongly to some of the early ideals of the revolution, including the rule of law, including the separation of powers and all things like that and so on. But these things were scarcely planned in order to deal with a war emergency. And that's the thing. And they didn't really have an approach to that, I think. And that was their fatal weakness. Apart from the fact that they made enemies of the people of Paris. Now, they made enemies of the people of Paris because they were committed to national sovereignty. And they said, why should the representatives of the nation be actually at the mercy of Parisian mobs? But the Parisian mobs didn't like that. And eventually they forced the convention to purge the Girondins.
Yeah, that's right. And this whole story is such a jaw dropper. In general, I don't have too much original to say about the French Revolution myself, but the experience of looking at it in 3 month chunks, it's just that it goes on and on and on, and every twist and turn is of such violence, literally, of course, but also, you know, if we were thinking of this in narrative terms, in plot terms, if we were trying to make a long running drama about it, there is so much that goes on so quickly that it's just unbelievable. And clearly, I suppose the effect of the war is that it creates that pressure and makes the stakes so much higher for literally everybody in the capital.
Can I just take up what you say about drama? Because a drama is really important there. I mean, people have often said that my big book on the Oxford history of the French Revolution ends on a hostile note when I call it a tragedy. The revolution was a tragedy. But a tragedy is not something which is... tragedy is about loss. Tragedy is not about damage so much, it's about loss. It's about things that ought to have gone right but didn't. And you see this in most of the great dramatic tragedies and so on. And the French Revolution is like that. It starts off with remarkably benevolent and optimistic aims and so on, but it all goes wrong because of internal flaws, just like the role of tragic heroes. So, you know, when I say it's a tragedy, I'm not saying it was bad. I'm saying actually it probably ought to have been good, but because of its internal flaws, it all went horribly wrong, and it took Napoleon to try and sort some of it out.
Well, just as a side note there, and to ask you about the question of how historical fiction or other works of drama have tried to have a go at dramatizing the French Revolution. I know this is an odd question to ask, but do you have any particular favorites that jump out in terms of, I mean, for example, I'm reading Hilary Mantel's novel about the French Revolution at the moment and quite enjoying it.
Yeah, I think that book's absolutely brilliant. I think apart from A Tale of Two Cities, it's the other great book of fiction on the French Revolution, I think. But it's interesting, you know, the way she brings out the ambiguities in Robespierre's attitude, for instance, which I think is absolutely spot on, absolutely dead right. It's a wonderful book, I think. I'm glad you're enjoying it.
Yeah, so that's A Place of Greater Safety.
That's right.
It is. I'm only about. Where am I? I'm just at the start of 1791, so I've still got quite a way to go with it. But I'm very much enjoying it so far. Maybe William, we could do something once I'm finished. But that,
right. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. That's really interesting. Now, you mentioned Napoleon Bonaparte there as somebody who is trying to sort out the French Revolution, and it's the responsibility of government, I suppose, to actually, you know, get to grips with the realities of the situation. It just seems to me it's such a big task that it would be beyond any one man's or woman's ability to really get going with it. And was there something about the particular character of Napoleon Bonaparte as somebody who was willing, who had the capacity, or maybe the intellectual egotism to think, yeah, I can do this. I can stand up and actually sort this out.
Yes, well, I mean, he says again, you know, you've got to be careful what he says looking back from St. Helena, but with there is so much about Napoleon it is around his own reminiscences there, and no historian of Napoleon can avoid going to St. Helena and listening to what Napoleon has recorded as having said and so on. And he says that after one of the first battles in Italy, when he's first given a full command, he said, you know, it's at this moment I suddenly began to think of myself as someone who is going to be special, someone who is going to be able to do things. And as I say, later on, during that campaign, he says, you know, I'm the one who's going to end the revolution. And he really begins to feel he can do this. And indeed, he shows that he could.
Well, he doesn't do too badly, it has to be said. But was there something about the mood at the time? I'm talking, we're not quite into romanticism just yet, but there's something about the individual, that the man of destiny, that's what I'm talking about, this idea of somebody who, which he clearly had when he went off to Egypt and got very excited by, and so that continued through. But was that particularly unusual, or were there lots of men of destiny and he was the one who happened to be in the right place at the right time?
Well, recently, I mean, David Bell in America has written a book about charismatic leaders, and one of whom is Napoleon. But he traces the idea of the charismatic leader to the late 18th century, at a time when these characters emerge, and Napoleon is one of his prime exhibits. And certainly a lot of people at the time, when they saw what he achieved, were in fact tremendously impressed. I suppose the most famous example is the disillusionment of Beethoven, you know, when he dedicated the Eroica Symphony to Napoleon, and then when he hears about him making himself emperor, he tosses it all out and says it's in the memory of a man. An example, you know, one of the great romantic composers actually being disillusioned because he thought he'd found a hero and found that hero as Peter Clare.
But that's what happens to everyone in government, isn't it? You know, the reality of the situation means that people's political capital sort of diminishes. But of course, in the general, the bigger story of the 1792 to 1815 period, this the period of your book, that those first years of the after Brumaire are just the warm up, you know, to what follows, and so how do you how do you cite your approach to this period? I mean, obviously you're coming from the French Revolution, that's more important, but how did you deal or manage with everyone knowing that 1805 to 1815, it's going to all step up to another level of bonkersness, to coin a word?
Yeah, well, I always think historians need to be very careful to forget the fact that they know what happened next. None of us know what happened next. I mean, look at the last few days. None of us expected what's happened in the Middle East to happen the way it did. You don't know what's going to happen next, and you've got to treat people in the past as not knowing either what is going to happen next. I think it is a great divide. The Peace of Amiens, I think, because, you know, before that, what Napoleon does is end the French Revolutionary Wars. But after that, these are Napoleonic wars. They're different things altogether. And the empire, the Napoleonic Empire, is a different beast from what you've had before. So it is a great divide, I think.
Yes, and indeed, that's right. Okay, so let's have a little look at Napoleon Bonaparte as the civilian administrator, the politician. We talked about that a bit in our 10 minutes, but could you say something now about the achievements that he made in these first few years?
Oh, well, the first thing he does is put his stamp on the constitution of the consulate in 1799. You know, originally the idea of CS, who wanted to revise the constitution, was that he would set up a sort of a constitutional monarch, but executive power would be in the hands of two consuls. And it's Napoleon who says, no, we're not having that at all. You know, we're going to have the executive power in the hands of the first consul, and the other two are not going to be of much consequence at all. So that's the first thing he does straight away, is assert that, you know. CS said to him, so you want to be a king, do you? And Napoleon said, no, I'm a good Republican, and so on. But actually, I don't think he did want to be a king, and eventually ended up being a bit more than a king. He ended up being an emperor. He knows what he wants, but he knows that he's got to proceed slowly and carefully in order to achieve these things. And he also knows that he needs to have support as well. I mean, he's got the support of people who were disgusted by the way the directory had failed to fulfill its promise, and so on. So he had to proceed carefully with them, you know, and you get that example when, you know, he expects the Senate make him first consul for life, and they say, oh well, you know, let's just make it 10 years and so on. And he's furious about that because he's underestimated the mistrust which even his loyal backers had towards him when they thought that he wanted to establish unlimited power. Eventually, they have to accept it. But that's just an example of the way, in fact, he was trying to move too fast and he backpedaled quite quickly. Another point, they said, oh, you know, you're going to make yourself a king. And he said, no, I've made kings, but I don't want to be one.
Yes, that's pretty good. That's a pretty good line. He did have a few good lines, didn't he? But do you think someone else would have handled things differently, or was it just that the hand that was dealt to whoever was going to be in charge in France in 1800 would have tended towards certain approaches? I mean, for example, you could see anybody who was in charge of France looking to reassert, to get Saint-Domingue back, basically that incredibly lucrative colony, and that's something that Napoleon Bonaparte does prioritize, even if it doesn't go very well.
I mean, that's his great failure. I mean, because he knows that that before the revolution, the most spectacular prosperity of France was based upon the slave-based economy of the Caribbean and so on. And the moment he knows there's going to be a deal with the British who control the seas, he immediately starts putting together a massive expedition to actually restore control in Saint-Domingue and so on. But it proves eventually his greatest failure and his first failure, really. I mean, up until that moment, it's been success all the way after Brumaire. He's been able to achieve all these things we've been talking about, but he's unable to reassert the Caribbean empire that was there before, and that's the first failure, I think.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of looking at it. Yeah, because I had when I was originally planning this project of the Napoleonic Quarterly, the idea was to break the period down into 96 3-month chunks and see how things develop, and I was testing whether, okay, well, are there going to be periods where things are a bit slower, and you know, maybe it's hard to find. And what was particularly worrying me back when I was doing this initial sort of chronological exercise was, oh gosh, I think things might, you know, you start off with the French Revolution, really, and lots going on, you know, loads to talk about when we get to Egypt and later on as well. But between Marengo and Austerlitz, say, is there going to be that much to talk about in 1801, 1802, 1803? And this is the period of your book, really, and as you know, four as well. And I now I'm getting to that period myself, and I've learned more about it, I have to say, and you know, getting away from I don't know, another biography of Napoleon, so in understanding the period a bit more, I can see that there's an awful lot to talk about. But what would you have said to the me of 10 years ago who was saying, oh, I think things might quieten down a bit between 1800 and 1804?
Well, you've got the whole, as I say, you've got the whole question of resolving that Caribbean problem. And that is a huge area of expansion of historical interest over the last 10-15 years or so. Saint-Domingue has become absolutely central, and some treatments you think, you know, it's almost as if it's become more important than the revolution itself. I mean, historians are really interested in this now, and it's very big stuff, and its implications are enormous, because once Napoleon recognizes that he's unable to recover Saint-Domingue, he has no point. He sees there's no point in holding Louisiana, because Louisiana was meant to be the place that would supply the basic sustenance for Saint-Domingue, which would be given over to the luxury products, coffee and sugar and things like that, and so on. So if Saint-Domingue is not going to be recovered, you don't need Louisiana. So you sell it to the United States, which, is one of the most important events in the whole history of the United States.
This happens in that period.
Well, there's plenty coming up for us to talk about on the Napoleonic Quarterly. And I will be keeping my fingers crossed, William, that we might be able to speak to you again for one or two of these developments in this period. But I must say, thank you so much for coming on now. It's a great pleasure to talk to you. Your book has been brilliantly timed as we now turn to this period ourselves on the Napoleonic Quarterly. So it's Napoleon at Peace, How to End a Revolution. And that is a question I bet Napoleon Bonaparte would have quite liked to have read a primer on how to end a revolution when he was coming in. Although I suspect he probably wouldn't have spent too much time reading it, perhaps, do you think? Or would he have said, no, I'm very confident, I know what I'm doing?
Well, he was a very well-read man, so who knows, he might have picked it up to read it.
Yes, well, it's there anyway. So, William, thank you very much.
My pleasure.